I could tell you a thousand tales of the men and women who have hunted this evil bird.
As I probed into its mysteries, every clue told me a different story.
And every story has the same ending.
But each had the same ending. Murder.
The people who made film noirs didn't know what they were making film noirs. It was named afterwards. A lot of them tend to have detectives or somebody who's searching for something. There's some with World War II veterans who are trying to find somebody who did something to them, things like that. But it's easy when you have a detective because he's always looking for something.
I'm a private dick on a case. Perhaps I'm asking too much, although it doesn't seem too much to me, somehow.
Hi, I'm Katie Marquette. You're listening to an original WYPR podcast, The Noir and Bizarre, and this is our fourth episode. And I thought it was about time that we tried to define that first part of the title, noir, a term most often associated with films from the 1940s and 50s. Films shot in grainy black and white, featuring straight-talking detectives and beautiful femme fatales. But what makes a film noir, and what are some of the classics? In this episode, I speak with a Baltimore film historian and researcher, Mark Sober. We're talking murder, intrigue, absurdity, and mystery. Stay tuned.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve?
They're demons.
Experience the excitement, the danger.
But it would be slightly more difficult to pull off now, though, don't you think?
Okay, my name's Mark Sober. I'm a reference librarian in the Humanities Department at Pratt Library. I'm also considered the film specialist at the library. Things characteristic of film noir, a lot of angles and flashbacks, another big thing in film noir. Flashbacks within flashbacks within flashbacks within flashbacks. It's amazing. This first-person narration from the point of view of the protagonist. And the protagonists aren't all... There's a lot of moral ambiguity in film noir, so protagonists aren't always real nice. Dashiell Hammett worked for the Pinkerton Detective Agency in Baltimore, which was in a building that had survived the Baltimore fire. You can still see it. It's at Calvert and Redwood Street, the Continental Building. And his first detective before Sam Spade was called the Continental Op, like operative. And also, over there's a big, like, three-story entranceway to the Continental Building. And above the entranceway, there's a couple of birds. In some pictures, they look black. They're either eagles or falcons. But he must have seen that every day when he went into the building.
The story of the Maltese falcon. 600 years, the falcon has carried the mystery of a fabulous wealth under its grotesque wings.
So he got the idea, you know, for detectives there, and he named the first detective after the building. Of course, he set it in San Francisco. He could have put Baltimore on a map. But he got a lot of experience here as a detective. He was only a detective for a few years until the war started, the First World War started. But like I say, Maltese Falcon is not my very favorite, although there's good things in it. There's a lot of good dialogue in it, especially with some of the villains.
$5,000.
You would clasp your hands together at the back of your neck. I intend to search your offices, Mr. Spade. I warn you, if you attempt to prevent me, I shall certainly shoot you.
Go ahead and search.
Will you please come to the center of the room? I have to make certain that you're not armed.
That's the first film noir. Like I say, there were things before that that could be called film noir, but it's probably one of the most famous, so they always cite that. Another Baltimore connection, and it applies to the Maltese Falcon. There was a magazine that a lot of these hard-boiled writers first published in. It was called The Black Mask. It was founded by H.L. Mencken and his partner. They had already sold the magazine by the time all these guys got published. But they knew that kind of story was really popular. And their main magazine, which was the Smart Set, which was a very sophisticated magazine, wasn't making money, so they wanted to have something that made money, so they started the Black Mask. And they only ran it for a couple of years, but it went on for years and years, and a lot. Maltese Falcon was first published as a serial in the Black Mask, and a lot of these other ones that became film noir were published there, so that's a Baltimore connection too.
Dashiell Hammett was born in St. Mary's County, Maryland in 1894, and is most famous for his hard-boiled detective fiction. The Maltese Falcon, the film based on Hammett's novel of the same name, came out in 1941, and as Mark said, it is most often cited as the first film noir. It was wildly popular, and it cemented Humphrey Bogart's reputation as a noir leading man. In a tongue-in-cheek trailer for the next film noir we're going to discuss, Bogart enters a bookstore and asks,
"Oh yeah, I'm looking for a good mystery yarn, something off the beaten track like the Maltese Falcon."
"Well, that was a fascinating story. But here's one that has everything the Falcon had and more. It's Raymond Chandler's latest bestseller, The Big Sleep. What a picture that'll make."
"Mind if I look at it?" "Sometimes I wonder what strange fate brought me out of the storm to that house that stood alone in the shadows."
The Big Sleep, written by the notoriously confusing and notoriously alcoholic writer Raymond Chandler, was a hard-boiled crime novel published in 1939. The movie by the same name came out in 1946 and proved a challenge to the screenwriters.
But the thing everybody remembers about The Big Sleep is how convoluted it is. And there's the story that the writers, one of whom was William Faulkner, one of the others was a woman named Lee Brackett. When she was hired to work on the film by Howard Hawks, he didn't know she was a woman because her name was Lee, and this 28-year-old woman walks in. He had read a novel by her, and she was a hard-boiled writer. She later became more famous for science fiction and screenwriting. She wrote the screenplay for Empire Strikes Back. She lasted a long time. She died before it came out. But so she was on it, and then some other writers were brought in to work on it a little bit. But they were, and the way they wrote it is Lee Brackett and William Faulkner divided it up. They do alternate chapters, and then he said, "Well, we'll put it all together." That might be one explanation for the performance, and although Howard Hawks did a lot of editing. But at one point they said, "Who killed the chauffeur?" And they couldn't figure out who killed the chauffeur. So somebody said, "Let's call Raymond Chandler." And they asked Raymond Chandler, "Who killed the chauffeur?" And he couldn't figure it out either, and he wrote the novel. All the women in that film really jump on Humphrey Bogart's character. It's got a lot of sexual energy in it. There's a great bit where he goes into a bookstore, and the woman, she's got glasses and her hair's tied back, and she winds up taking her glasses off, and it's Dorothy Malone, who is really attractive. You don't see it, but you assume they're gonna go off together as soon as that shot is over.
"Looks like we're closed for the rest of the afternoon."
Many scenes were cut from the movie to make more screen time for the smoky-voiced Lauren Bacall, newly married to her co-star, Humphrey Bogart. Their on-screen chemistry is palpable.
"You know, I don't see what there is to be cagey about, Mr. Marlowe. And I don't like your manners."
"Well, I'm not crazy about yours. I didn't ask to see you. I don't mind if you don't like my manners. I don't like them myself. They're pretty bad. I grieve over them long winter evenings, and I don't mind your ritzing me or drinking your lunch out of a bottle. But don't waste your time trying to cross-examine me."
"People don't talk to me like that."
"Oh."
You might recognize Bacall's voice from this podcast theme.
"You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow."
It's one of the best scenes in all of film, in my humble opinion, from the 1944 movie To Have and Have Not, based on the Ernest Hemingway novel of the same name. Not technically a film noir, but since this was the movie in which two noir greats, Bacall and Bogart, fell in love, both on screen and off, it seemed appropriate to me.
"Junior, I don't want you to take my shoes off. I don't want you to get me any breakfast. I don't want you to draw me a nice hot bath. I don't want you
Isn't
to...
Isn't there anything I can do, Steve?"
"Yes, get the..."
"You know, Mr. Morgan, you don't make me angry when you say that. I don't think I'll ever be angry again at anything you say."
The next film we're going to discuss is Out of the Past, based on the novel Build My Gallows High by Daniel Mainwaring, starring Robert Mitchum as the troubled detective, and Jane Greer as the beautiful, alluring, and ultimately deadly Kathy Moffat.
Out of the Past probably has as many elements of film noir as any. At least half of the film is a flashback where he talks about how he got to where he is. But he was a detective who was hired by a gangster, played by Kirk Douglas, to find his girlfriend who tried to kill him and ran off with his money. And I think that girlfriend is the very best femme fatale ever.
No, I just want her back. When you see her, you'll understand better. Maybe she's just an impulsive girl.
So Robert Mitchum tracks her down to Mexico, and he falls for her. And it's got great lines. My favorite line, he says to Jane Greer, who plays Kathy, the femme fatale, "You're just like a leaf that blows from gutter to gutter." And the other line, somebody says to him, "Nobody's all bad," and he says, "She comes closest." He has moved to the country and thinks he's going to live a decent life. He's got a girlfriend, he runs a gas station, and then one day, one of Kirk Douglas's minions walk in on him, so he's been discovered. So it's all bright in the country, but all the scenes in the city where he's a detective are very dark. And there's a little subplot where it gets a little convoluted, where they're going to frame him. He's supposed to find somebody, and they've killed the person, and he figures it out, and he covers his tracks. I really love that film. If I had to pick one film to represent film noir, it's just got as many elements as any film noir, I think. The one film I know, the second half of the title of your program is bizarre, and the most bizarre film noir is Nightmare Alley.
I wonder why I'm like that.
Like what?
I'm never thinking about anybody except myself.
Nightmare Alley is a disturbing film noir with a carnival backdrop, filmed in 1947 and based on the novel by the same name, written by William Lindsay Gresham. Just a brief aside, Gresham was from Baltimore and was married to a woman named Joy Davidman, who would ultimately divorce Gresham and marry the famous Christian writer C.S. Lewis. This really blew my mind when Mark told me. Just a little bizarre connection for you.
I'm going to be strictly on the level about this whole thing myself.
Will you get out of here? I should have known you were that kind of a...
Takes one to catch one.
Tyrone Power, who had just made, I think, The Razor Edge, where he's on a spiritual quest. And he was most known for being a romantic lead, he played Zorro. He wanted to do something different, and you couldn't get more different. Probably the plot in Nightmare Alley is one of the most straightforward plots. It's like the rise and fall of this guy. He goes to work at a carnival. He's a roustabout, and then he becomes a carnival barker. And the person that's most looked down upon in the carnival is the geek. For those who don't know what a geek is, it's usually a drunk old man who bites the heads off of chickens, which was a real attraction for some reason. And he looks down upon this geek, and the geek is actually married to one of the females in the film who they had earlier before he became a geek, because again, he was an alcoholic. They had a mind reading act where he'd be below the stage and he'd flash her the information and everything. And Tyrone Power character learns how to do all that from the wife, whose name is Zena, played by Joan Blondell, I think. And he learns all of this from her and then sort of throws her over for this young woman who he winds up marrying, partly under duress, I think. But she works there too. And he goes on to become this society mind reader. His name is Stanton something, but his name is like the Great Stanton. So, and he goes too far. He tries to make his wife appear as a dead woman to this rich guy so he can make lots of money. And she just finally can't go along with it. So when she gets close to the guy, she says, I can't do this. And that's the beginning of the end for the Jerome Power character.
I'm no good. I never pretended to be. But I love you. I'm a hustler. I've always been one. But I love you. I may be the thief of the world, but with you, I've always been on a level.
To me, film noirs represent old-time glamour. The men are tough, the women are beautiful. They are erotic and confusing and endlessly entertaining. But at the same time, nothing is quite as it seems. The films may be in black and white, but the morality of the story is always kept in shades of gray. The absurdity and ambiguity reflect a world disenchanted after World War II and searching for answers. The films we talked about today are just a handful of films that could be considered noir. There are so many more to see and explore. And you can find a lot of them online. Here in Baltimore, we have a rich film community. If you get a library card, you can take DVDs out. You can go to theaters like the Parkway, the Senator, and the Charles, many of which will feature noir films. Thanks to Mark Sober for talking with me. This man knows just about everything about film, and it was truly an honor to talk with him. On our next episode of The Noir and Bizarre, I'm handing the mic over to audio engineer and producer Adam Droneberg. He's discovered some pretty wild history lurking underneath Lexington Market here in Baltimore.
In 2016, we went underground to explore the place for ourselves. We got into the catacombs through an old abandoned restaurant called Tubbs, which is still sitting in the basement of the West Market, untouched. The restaurant closed in 1988 after losing its liquor license for having go-go dancers. Now, the space seems stuck in time, with bright red carpets from the 70s and a sign offering Miller Lite at 50 cents.
They must have had a, like you said, a wedding or something down here, all these little bits of confetti everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Or it might have been the last party.
No more dancers, no crab cake sandwiches, just a carnival tent backdrop and some dishware heaped up in corners, as if whoever was cleaning the place gave up halfway through.
Man, just plates and everything just laid. It's like, this is what always kind of astonishes me about these places that get abandoned like this. It's like the last day just of the restaurant stopped, everything stopped where it was, and then stuff just slowly kind of migrates over time with people coming in and out.
Towards the back of the restaurant, behind a heavy steel door, some old concrete steps lead underground into the catacombs.
Okay, yeah, this is starting to look more like a catacomb.
Make sure you download A Noir and Bizarre so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. You can also check out some of the other amazing local podcasts being produced by WYPR online at wypr.org/podcastcentral. The Noir and Bizarre is an original WYPR production, hosted and produced by me, Katie Marquette. Until next time, thanks for listening.